The Little House on the Prairie books have been favorites of adults and children alike. And here in Wisconsin, we feel a special kind of pride and ownership since the stories began with Laura Ingalls Wilder's earliest years in the Little House in the Big Woods right here in our state.
What fans of the books and the subsequent TV series might not know is that while she wrote several books about her life that became the Little House series, she didn't really keep a diary or journal in her adult years, but she was a big-time letter writer with lots of correspondence with family, friends, and her many fans.
William Anderson joins us now. He's written several books about Laura Ingalls Wilder, and his most recent release this month is called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Well, what is unique about this new collection of letters?
Well, one of the unique qualities is that we are probably at the end of Laura Ingalls Wilder's written words. Since her death in 1957, a number of her books that had gone unpublished during her lifetime have seen print and always were welcomed a great deal by her readers. And this collection of letters is most likely, barring any exciting discovery in an attic or drawer or repository, this is probably the last of her written words. And it's significant because, as you mentioned, Wilder didn't keep journals or diaries in her adult life, except when she was on a vacation. So the letters more or less tell of her life from 1894 to 1956 in her own words, in the form of correspondence.
And it was quite a task to gather all this correspondence together, because, of course, she'd written it to different people. Some has been lost. Some of her correspondence, I understand, was even burned at one point.
It was. And this has been a book that's been on the back burner for 20 years, and finally the time seemed right, and I had collected and used a lot of her correspondence when I wrote books like Laura Ingalls Wilder, A Biography, and Laura Ingalls Wilder Country, and so on. So I had neatly filed in dated file folders all of these letters during that long span of her adult life. So when it became evident that HarperCollins wanted to do this book, I just had to pull those files out of my cabinet and start working with them, annotating them, editing. And it will truly be an unending process, because I've done quite a few appearances lately in connection with this book, and almost every one of the events, somebody comes forth with a letter that they received from Wilder or their parents received. So there are thousands of them out there even yet today.
And what's striking to me as I read through these, both personal letters to family members and also to fans, is that her tone is really intimate in these. She confides, she sort of gives part of herself away in these letters. So these fan letters that you're talking about, I imagine they just won't be, you know, standard by rote form letters. There could be real things in there.
Well, there really were, and I had such a plethora of the fan letters to use that we'd have to do a volume two of this book to make them fit. So I selected good representative letters that she wrote to her admirers, which range from parents to teachers to librarians, but mostly the school kids of America that were exposed to her books in elementary school, and then felt called to write to her and tell her how much they appreciated those stories.
Well, let's hear. You've got some, I think, that you can read to us. You have one of the many letters she wrote to school kids. I think one dated June 15th, 1945, titled, "I would be glad to have you call on me." Can you share that one with us?
I will. That was an open invitation. And believe it or not, Wilder more or less had open house during the summer months, because people on their vacations would stop by Rocky Ridge Farm in Mansfield, Missouri, rap on the door, and she was really the first tour guide of her home, which is now a historic museum, and she was very gracious. Of course, she signed books and posed for pictures and answered questions and very proudly showed a lot of the visitors through that unique home that she and her husband Almanzo had built. So in June of 45, she had decided that she couldn't answer individually the maybe 30 letters or so that came from a classroom, so she'd write a group letter. And she says, "Thank you for your nice letters. I'm glad you like my stories of the long ago. It was rough riding in covered wagons in those days. It was quite different from riding on soft cushions over springs of a car as we do now. And we did have hard times, but we didn't let them beat us. We had good times and were happy, even if we sometimes had bad luck. I fed chickens and milked cows, too, for many years after I was married, and 300 chicks are a good many to raise, but they are lots of fun to watch grow. Almanzo and I still like animals. We have a big brown and white bulldog now, 3 milk goats, and a Rocky Mountain burro. They're all spoiled pets. When our only child, Rose, was a baby, we had a great St. Bernard dog who used to take care of her. Almanzo is 88 years old, and I am 78. I'm glad you liked to hear Pa's fiddle in the stories. You may like to know that I gave the fiddle to the South Dakota Historical Society. If any of you come past here, I would be glad to have you call on me. But perhaps you would be disappointed to see Laura so grown up, for it has been many years since she was the girl in the stories. With love to you all, I am, yours sincerely, Laura Ingalls Wilder.
That's such a great letter, and I love that she's actually willing to have, you know, the people call on her to come see her. You're not going to see that, you know, today.
Not in this day and age, but those were more innocent times, and she felt very comfortable hosting those that came to visit.
Talking to William Anderson, his new book is The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Looking at this, Bill, it makes me think of what a unique position she was in. She was a living person, but also I think a lot of people saw her both as a personal friend based on reading the Little House books, but also this living artifact of history. How did she deal with that, I don't know, unique role? I can't think of anyone else who had put in that position.
Well, I think the reason that she was propelled to write her books was that she looked at her own life and saw this huge and rather quick transition from covered wagons and log cabins and frontier life into the modern era of the 20th century. And she moved along with that. They lived in a modern home. They had a car. She flew in an airplane. And she just looked back and she thought, all of this pioneer life has pretty much vanished. And she thought, I really need to write down my stories so that the children of today will know what America was just one generation ago.
Now, we're talking about her from here in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin does feature into her stories. Does it also feature at all, you know, in her letters?
She got many, many letters from Wisconsin, naturally, since the children read Little House in the Big Woods, which takes place near Pepin, Wisconsin. And it's amazing, this huge letter flow that came to her after her books were well launched. She saved all the fan letters, and they're really delightful to read, and I included a few of them in this book. And they asked questions, and they talked about their favorite stories. And I remember one letter she received from a farm boy named Paul. That's the way he signed the letter. And he told her that he lived very near Lake Pepin, and during that previous summer, he had worked very hard picking beans and vegetables and so on to earn the money to buy all of her books. And I'm sure that was very heartwarming.
Obviously, she captured the hearts of a lot of people over the years. And clearly, Bill, that includes you. You've spent a lot of your professional life researching and writing about Laura Ingalls Wilder. What was it? What captivated you?
I was indoctrinated in those books in third grade, and I really realized that was rite of passage for generations of American school children right up to the present time. We were part of a movement, I guess, in education that used the books since they were first published in the 30s and 40s. And as a third grader, I was just an ambivalent reader, but I got real fascinated in history and the frontier by hearing those books read aloud before lunchtime in third grade. And became a history instructor and a researcher, and all of my books are about American icons like Mount Rushmore, Mark Twain, the Von Trapp family, and so on. And a big chunk of my written list of books are about the Wilder family.
Did you ever feel like you got close to her, writing all these books about her, and then also reading her letters, really kind of seeing the inside of her mind?
Well, I had used those letters, as I mentioned, in writing a couple biographical books about her. But I had a very interesting epiphany when I was working on this book, because I had to type all these letters. And that was very different than simply reading them and taking notes from them and using them as source material. And as you mentioned, at this late date in doing this research in many of these Wilder-related books, I felt I was really hearing the voice as I typed each one of these letters and edited and annotated them. And that's what I hope readers will get from this. It's another visit with this favorite person of children's books.
We're talking with William Anderson right now. He's written several books about Laura Ingalls Wilder. His most recent is called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Laura Ingalls Wilder and the Little House books? What is it about her story that captured your imagination? Is there a part of the story after the books that you're curious about? And is this something that you've introduced to your own kids, maybe your students at a school? Bill Anderson will take your calls, answer your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Bill Anderson. He's written several books about Laura Ingalls Wilder. His most recent is The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
And we'd love to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Were you a fan of the Little House books when you were a kid? Have you passed that along to your own children? And what do you think it is about the Ingalls clan that stays with us so many years later? If you've got a connection, call 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. Joan is on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Joan?
Well, I'm a retired teacher, and I was a reading specialist for many years, and I'd go into the classrooms once a week for enrichment, and I shared with the kids the Laura books. They absolutely loved it. We always had a Laura day on her birthday, and every summer I took them on a field trip up to Pepin, Wisconsin, and to Baroque Hotel. And I also, my husband went with me, and that's back before computers. I went to each of the sites except the one in New York and took the 35-millimeter slides and had slideshows
wow.
for the kids.
Joan, thank you so much for sharing that. And Bill, I'm guessing you've heard stories like this before, and Laura Ingalls Wilder herself probably heard from people with similar stories.
Everybody that I meet in this connection has a Wilder story. And Laura Ingalls Wilder had that same experience because so many teachers wrote to her about how important those books were in the curriculum. I remember one letter that she received from a teacher, and the teacher shared that when I took Little House on the Prairie down off the shelf to read before lunchtime, the room immediately fell silent. So they were good disciplinary methods, too.
We're going to go next to Laura, joining us from Keeler. Laura, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what did you...
My mom was born in 1940 and grew up then reading the books, and she decided that she loved the name Laura because of the Laura books, that that's how I got my name. It took her three kids, but she named me Laura.
Nice.
And then the same thing happened, but my favorite childhood books were about the Madeleine series, the little French girl, and so that's my daughter's name. So we've kind of been going off of our favorite books to name our children.
Wow, so you guys have a family tradition of picking child baby names from these books. How do you like having Laura for a namesake?
I truly love it. Feel honored that I can try to carry on her greatness.
Laura, thank you so much for sharing that story. Appreciate it.
And Bill, are there a lot of Lauras out there with the same kind of story?
I've met quite a few of them, and they show up at the various museums in the summer, and they're very proud to say they're named after Laura Ingalls Wilder. We have had a few Almanzos, but not too many. Not too many.
Laura, thanks so much for that call. We'll go next to Carolyn in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I not only have a nearby connection to the farm that, in Wisconsin that Lauren Gull's family had, but also I was a grade school student in the 1950s, and I was a voracious reader. And when I was in second grade, I received the complete collection of the Little House books. And I just read them and read them and read them. And all my friends wanted to read them. But we did not live near a public library. So my dad taught me how to type in second grade and bought me library book cards and book pockets. And I made a little public library in my basement. And all my friends checked out the books. And I still have them. With the checkout card and the date due slips and my rather childish handwriting at the time. Also went into that collection where the Anne of Green Gables books and another one of my favorites, which was Caddy Woodlawn.
That is such a great story, and I want to stay on the line. We're going to put you on hold, and I want you to talk to Judith, and I want to have a picture of your library cards for your Little House Lending Library. Thank you so much for that story. I really appreciate that. Bill, talk about people didn't just read these stories and be done with them. They wanted to share them with other people, didn't they?
They certainly did, and in families, we've already mentioned that these are books that are handed down from generation to generation, and the Ingalls and Wilder families are spoken of almost as if they're members of the extended family. So it's a wonderful tradition.
We're talking with William Anderson right now, the author of several books about Laura Ingalls Wilder. The latest one, the one we're talking about today, is called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And Bill, Laura was really close to her only child named Rose. She was also a writer, and there's been discussion over the years about whether Rose was maybe the ghostwriter of these books. What did you find about that aspect and also just the relationship in these letters?
The letters between Laura and her daughter Rose are probably the heart of this book because in a period of 1936 to 1940, the books were coming out very regularly, one every 2 years, sometimes one every year. And the correspondence between Laura and Rose indicate that they had a close collaboration, and the stories were all, of course, Laura Ingalls Wilder's. But Rose, as a very savvy and highly published and paid short story writer and novelist and journalist, she was the in-house editor for her mother. And when Rose was far away from the farm in Missouri, maybe in New York City, they had to carry on their collaboration and teamwork through correspondence. And fortunately, a lot of this still exists, and it is in this book, The Selected Letters. And it gives us a real insight into the craft of the writing of Little House books and how this was a family project during the Depression years and how mother and daughter collaborated.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Eric on the line in Eau Claire. Eric, hi.
Hi, thanks for having this topic. My dad read all the Laura Ingalls Wilder books to us. We even went on a summer family vacation and hit all the hot spots between here and the Dakotas. And for one Christmas, we got a tin cup and an Indian head penny. And that was our Christmas gift. It was the same thing that Laura got when she, I think, was in the Big Woods. So we got to appreciate how little she got and how great she thought that was.
Eric, thanks so much for that call. And that's part of the thing here, the lessons people are learning. And in a lot of the letters, she has a similar phrase, something, a positive message about appreciating what you have, dealing with adversity, as you heard in that early letter. She had a message for people, didn't she, Belle?
She certainly did. The books are a message about family unity, security, collaboration for survival and independence, self-reliance, all those virtues that her parents valued and she and her husband Almanzo valued as well.
Do you think that in a way she was nostalgic for those early years as a as a pioneer with her family battling adversity. There were some parts in the letters where she said, I actually think we were happier back then with all those tough challenges than we are in this modern world. Was she really maybe a person better suited to the earlier part of her life and the time that she lived in then?
Her daughter Rose said that my mother lives with both feet firmly planted in the 19th century. And in her letters, she mentions that a battle between man and nature is a lot cleaner fight than man versus technology or modern times. So she was nostalgic for the old independence that she felt they had in the big woods of Wisconsin and out on the prairies.
Bill, I got to ask, you mentioned that this is likely the last batch of writing we're going to get from Laura Ingalls Wilder. As somebody who has devoted his life to studying that, do you feel kind of sad knowing that you're not going to get another treasure trove like this?
I really feel that we're fortunate that so much of her unpublished works were saved, that they're accessible. The bulk of her original manuscripts and writings are located at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, and they've given scholars and writers years and years of material to research and write about. So it's just amazing that these people saved just about every piece of paper that they wrote on.
And Bill, as we wrap up, and you can hear people's love as they talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder, do you think that the generation of kids coming up today is going to have that same experience with her that the previous generations did?
I hope so. And I was a guest at Pepin's Wilder Days last September. That's her birthplace, of course, and they have a wonderful weekend festival. And I looked around and I saw all of these young families there with their kids. I saw children like 4 years old that were out at the log cabin site that sat down to listen to stories, and they were conversant in the characters and some of the episodes already. So I think this is being handed on down, and it's such priceless Americana and history that it's a good learning tool as we get further and further away from those pioneer times.
And Bill, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Bill Anderson. His newest book is The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, The Guardian U.S. published leaked court documents from Wisconsin's John Doe investigation earlier this week. We'll talk about this and other news in our weekly Wisconsin Roundup with Rob Mentzer. First, September is a month dedicated to something you probably have sitting in your kitchen, honey. And if you just use that honey in your tea, our guest says there's a whole lot more you can do with it. Joining us now is Zeke Freeman. He calls himself a recovering chef, and he's the founder and CEO of the honey company B-E-E Raw. Zeke, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I say the word honey, but looking around at some of your recipes and things like that, just one word doesn't seem to do it. There's a lot of variety, it sounds like, in honey. Can you talk about where that variety comes from and how much difference it makes?
Yeah, you nailed the word there, variety. And so what we call the types of honeys that we do are varietal honeys. And that means that our honeys come from a specific floral source. And what happens is our beekeepers, they take their bees and they place them in a buckwheat field or an orange grove or a wild raspberry patch. And the bees collect the nectar from that specific floral source and they make honey from it. And that changes everything, the color, the texture, and obviously the flavor of the honey.
Yeah,
we don't do anything. We leave it raw, completely unprocessed, and you get just an enormous difference from what you would find in your grocery store in the honey bear.
Yeah, you make a big case for raw honey. Why is that? Why does that make so much difference if it's not pasteurized?
Sure. So being a recovering chef, it's all about flavor, right? It's all about flavor for us. So while there are health benefits to raw honey, the enzymes are intact, all of that good stuff. They're really what matters to me is that the flavor stays intact. So when the honey is heated and processed and super filtered, you lose a lot of the texture and flavor qualities that raw honey presents.
And what's the difference side by side between that container of honey that I might have had sitting on my shelf for a year and some really good fresh varietal honeys?
Yeah, I think what you're going to see is one, that honey on your shelf is probably still liquid, which means that all of the pollen and the good stuff has been filtered out of it. And a lot of that's where the flavor is present. And you're going to see that the raw honey may begin to crystallize, you know, over a couple of days or a week. And that that crystallization actually adds a lot of interesting texture and flavor and melts in your mouth more slowly and gives you a lot more nuance to the honey.
Now let's talk about cooking with honey. Again, I am pretty limited in my daily uses of honey. Honestly, I don't really think of it as part of my cooking palate. Make the case that I should start thinking of it that way.
You know, the way I think about it is, you know, I usually have four or five honeys in my pantry and treat them the same as I treat different spices in my pantry. You know, our goal is to take people past tea and toast. So, you know, I certainly do a ton of savory recipes with honey. We're going to talk about a couple of chicken wing recipes that I do this time of year. I have this amazing butternut squash recipe, but I also do fun things like cocktails and cheese pairings. And I'm sure your Wisconsin folks are going to love about hearing about the cheese pairings.
Let's go right there. Yeah, we are in Wisconsin. Honey and cheese is a thing I really wouldn't have thought of pairing. I think I've heard of it happening on a plate at you know, hip restaurants and things like that. How do we go about pairing honey with cheese?
So the way we go about it is we like to, first of all, you can't go wrong. If you choose a honey and a cheese, you know, it's probably going to be pretty good. We get a little nerdy about it. So we break up the different styles of cheese and pair them with specific honeys. So for example, like Alpine cheese, like Gruyere, we really like with our Meadow Foam honey. And Meadow Foam, is this honey that comes from Oregon and has these really like cotton candy creme brulee notes that pair really well with like the nuttiness and sweetness of your Alpine style cheeses. On the contrary, our buckwheat honey, which is this giant, big, kind of molassesy, barnyardy honey that's dark, dark, dark brown, almost black, goes fantastically with your fresh cheeses like ricotta or fresh goat cheese or even yogurt.
Big fan of aged cheddars in my house, good, sharp cheddar. What kind of honey goes well with that?
I like orange blossom with that. I find that the floral citrus notes really kind of pair nicely with cheddars.
So it sounds we can really nerd out with honey. It sounds like we could treat honey like wine or like people are getting with beer if we want to.
Unquestionably, and you know, certainly when we talk about it, we often talk about it in the same way as we talk about wine. We actually have flights of honey in the way that you would have a flight of wine.
We are getting nerdy with honey. We're cooking with honey on this edition of Food Friday. Zeke Freeman is with us, founder and CEO of the honey company Be Raw, and he's been a chef himself over the years. So, Zeke, let's get into some of the recipes and the cooking you mentioned. You mentioned those chicken wings, and I saw you had three different sauces. So you make up the wings, and you've got three different honey-based sauces to serve with them. Talk us through some of those sauces.
Yeah, so this is really kind of a fun way to do your football party or any party, you know, this time of year is you start your chicken wings in the oven, you split them up into three separate trays, you get them going, and you cook them for about 40 minutes. And in the meantime, I have three different sauces that I do. I do a sriracha honey ginger glaze. I do more of your traditional buffalo wing glaze, and then more of a soy Asian ginger glaze. And so you get these multiple different flavors, and you know it's just super easy preparation. So as your chicken wings are roasting, you create these three different sauces. You split each of them in half, and then 40 minutes goes by. You toss each one of the sheet pans in half the sauce. You toss them back in the oven for another 20 minutes. They come out and they're ready to go. And then you have the rest of the sauce for dipping.
Sounds great. And I guess it's not that surprising. I think of barbecue sauces sometimes will have honey in them. So that's sure. I guess, a mental starting point here.
Absolutely.
And then we've got a recipe. This one is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And we've been thinking about it for a little bit now. A candied honey bacon. Talk us through
that.
Sounds
good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, this one, you know, is fun by itself. as a snack or, you know, dunked in your Bloody Mary. But it's also really great for, like, crumbling up into a salad.
Ooh,
is
yeah.
really interesting. And I've also ground it up a little bit and tossed it into popcorn, which is out of sight. So, you know, this is really easy. You know, it's a little bit of Dijon mustard, some cayenne pepper, some orange blossom honey. You mix those items together. You toss a pound of bacon into it. And then you put them in an oven, a 350-degree oven, you know, for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. And the real key to this recipe is letting them bake long enough that they get crispy. You have to really let them get dark, probably darker than you might think, because if you don't, it can have that kind of soggy-ish, like, you know, chewy-ish, as opposed to, like, a really nice crispy bite. But, yeah, a lot of fun to garnish things with. You can really, you know, play around with it a bit.
Is that long enough and hot enough for the honey to caramelize a little bit on the bacon, or does it just kind of soak in?
No, it definitely, the whole thing caramelizes. It definitely gets really hot, and that's the key to making sure you leave it in long enough so the things really darken up, really dark brown.
That sounds fantastic. Again, that one for the candied honey bacon is available. You can find a link to Zeke's recipe there on the Central Time Facebook page. And you mentioned butternut squash. And Zeke, I'm really excited because we're coming up on winter squash season here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
What can we do with honey? What kind of honeys go well with a butternut squash?
So for this recipe, I really like buckwheat honey. And I mentioned buckwheat before, and buckwheat's, you know, we call it the Guinness of honey because it really has this dark brown black color and this big, big flavor that's really earthy. So it really kind of plays, it's probably while it's sweet, it's our most savory honey. So it really plays well with other sweet things and actually can bring an earthy characteristic to a dish. So in this case, there's actually two ways that I like to do it. You can do it where you just half the butternut squash, seed it, and then brush the butternut squash with the honey, roast it for a little while, brush a little bit more on, roast it for a little while. And that's probably the easy, most family-friendly way to do it. Additionally, you can slice it up into kind of quarter, half-inch pieces and toss the squash in the honey and then sauté it for, you know, 5-7 minutes, and you get this just really coated squash dish that really holds together and has this nice kind of earthy brown color. Really beautiful.
I like the sounds of that second way. So we're just tossing it and then olive oil or something to marinate or to saute in?
No, just the honey.
Just the honey.
The honey. Yeah, super, super simple.
Is that going to stick to my pan?
It will stick to your pan, but the moisture of the butternut squash releases as you're cooking. You know, you're keeping this over kind of a low medium heat, and so the goal is for the moisture from the butternut squash to release as you're cooking this, and you know, so you, at the end you get more of a glaze that will stick but shouldn't burn.
That sounds fantastic.
And then at the end of it, towards the end, you do a little grated orange zest in there, and it just kind of creates this little pop of freshness.
That sounds great and pretty easy. It is National Honey Month. We're talking to Zeke Freeman. He is founder and CEO of the company Be Raw. We are talking about cooking with honey, not just sweet stuff, savory stuff too, as we've been hearing. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foods to pair with honey? Do you use honey as a sweetener for desserts or as a glaze in some of your savory recipes? Do you try different kinds of honey? Are you a honey connoisseur or do you make your own honey? This is Wisconsin. These things happen. Tell us what types of honey you like using and get some advice, too, from Zeke. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post and find a recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Zeke Freeman, founder and CEO of the honey company Be Raw, and we're talking about cooking with honey. I've learned a ton already, a lot of things I want to try. the candied honey bacon recipe on our Central Time Facebook page, mixing up some honey with squash. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Tell us how you cook with honey, what types of honey you like to use. Do you mix honey in with your fall recipes? Have you made honey with squash? Or do you want some advice from Zeke? He's got a zillion recipes up on his website. He can probably answer your honey-related cooking questions. Again, call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Zeke, before we go to our callers, let's talk a little bit about drinking our honey. You've got a couple of cocktail ideas using honey.
Oh yeah. That's probably my biggest passion is making cocktails. I mean, personally, I'm a fan of a cocktail. But you know, getting people to use honey in cocktails is pretty intriguing because people just, you know, most people like cocktails. So it's like, if you take your standard cocktail, like a margarita, and you swap out what is normally agave or sugar or, you know, sour mix and add honey, you get a really spectacular, you know, drink. So, you know, my recipe is, you know, 2 ounces of tequila, 2 ounces of, you know, orange blossom, honey, and, you know, one part of fresh lime juice. You know, all those fresh ingredients are so important. You mix it up, you know, and it's just like the simplest, cleanest drink you've had. So I'm a big fan. Whether it's a margarita or a caipirinha or, you know, a mojito, honey makes it better.
Zeke, we got to get you out here to host a party for some time. Those chicken wings with the sauces, these cocktails. This sounds great. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question about, like, chocolate chip cookies or a typical recipe you would use sugar in. Is there a ratio that you can apply to replace the sugar with honey?
There is. Usually you use about 2/3 less honey than sugar. Honey is a bit sweeter. And then you have to consider that honey is a liquid, so sometimes you have to up the amount of flour that you use as well.
Interesting. Mike, thanks for that call. Is there a good type of honey for your basic old-fashioned chocolate chip cookie that you'd recommend, Zeke?
Yeah, you know, we actually have a Wisconsin cranberry honey, which I'm a big fan of and I think is, you know, really fantastic in baking.
That sounds great. Thanks for that call, Mike. We'll go next to Lane in Wind Lake. Lane, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Zeke, I just wanted to ask Zeke, my wife's uncle sells honey in New Berlin, and he actually has given me some with actually the honeycomb part of it, and I was wondering if Zeke could explain how to actually eat the honeycomb itself.
You know, the honeycomb is pretty fantastic. You know, it's kind of like, I think of it kind of like chewing gum. You know, you cut off a corner of it, you chew on it until, you know, all the honey is gone, and then you spit out, you know, what's left. It's pretty simple and really enjoyable because there's nothing more fresh than honey in the comb.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, it can't get much fresher than that. Zeke, does that taste even better still than a raw honey out of a jar?
Yeah, there's something pretty special about it that way.
That's great. Well, Lane, I hope that helps you next time the uncle gives you a honeycomb. I'll go next to AJ in Madison. AJ, hi.
Hello there. I have a comment and also a question here. Just how I use honey myself in the house. My favorite is buckwheat. And I have it around almost always. And I typically use it to spice up really healthy snacks. So I'll mix it into anything from peanut butter to put on my pretzels, into my yogurt or my Greek yogurt. And even just adding it into a smoothie for a little bit more flavor. That's generally how I like to mix it up. Or even into some like mustard. Make your own little honey mustard and top different vegetables and things like that with there. So that's kind of how I use it, even if it's not cooking. It's very simple to use. You can add it to anything. My question is along the lines of the craft beer scene. Since we are here in Wisconsin, you know, that's kind of a big part of our lives. I did a little homebrew once that included fresh honey. But do you have more comment? Do you know how that's being used, if there are local brewers or crafts around the country that are doing that more?
Honey in our beer, so, Zeke, yeah.
I know. Honey in your beer, mead, all these things, they're really, really popular, both of those things. It's something that I haven't done any myself, But we know a lot of people who do, and we sell honey to a number of mead makers and a few beer makers, and they find that you know even those varietal honeys can really make a significant difference in their brew.
Thanks a lot for that call, AJ. We're talking to Zeke Freeman. He is a recovering chef. He's founder and CEO of the honey company Bee Raw. We're talking about cooking with honey, making cocktails with honey, grilling with honey. Very, very versatile stuff and a lot of variety out there, too. We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Deborah is on the line in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hello. I wanted to know if you have any ideas for honey mustard. And also, I have a cousin who's actually a rocket scientist. I mean, literally, he is a genius. But he cooked when I was living there for a while at his apartment in New Jersey for a while, peanut butter chicken. And I thought, oh, and I recently bought honey peanut butter with honey in it. And it was awesome. And I thought, you don't have to have the jelly, just the peanut butter, and it's got the honey in it. So how about, like, do you have any ideas for honey mustard or honey peanut butter chicken or anything?
Deborah, thanks a lot for the call. And Zeke, I'll let you know that we are the home in Wisconsin of the Mustard Museum, where we learned that there are tons of varieties of mustard, too. Have you worked on pairing varieties of honey with varieties of mustard?
In fact, I have, and there are a couple of recipes on my site. I have two. One is my buckwheat honey with a whole grain French style mustard, which is probably my favorite. And again, that big earthiness of the buckwheat honey, instead of things kind of getting sickly sweet, it really the tartness of the mustard with the earthiness of the buckwheat honey and the little bit of sweet really elevate it to something more than what you might make, you know, from that honey bear honey.
Well, and you could just experiment too, it sounds like. Get some mustard,
sure.
Get some honeys and go to town.
Absolutely.
Deborah, hope that helps. Thanks for that call. Rebecca is on the line next in Galesville. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. I'm hyperglycemic, so I can't eat any refined sugar, so I use honey quite frequently. My question is, I've heard several times, I'm not sure if it's fact or fiction, which I'm hoping you can help me with, whether or not there's a certain type of honey that is more sustainable than another.
More sustainable in terms of on the glycemic value or in terms
or do you mean
of
environmentally,
how it's produced,
Rebecca?
Environmentally?
Environmentally produced, yes.
Okay. So environmentally polluted. So what's really important about, you know, choosing something that's environmentally sustainable in terms of honey is getting it from someone local or someone like myself who is working directly with the beekeepers. Most of the stuff that you're going to find in the grocery store is being imported from China, from Argentina, is blended together, so on and so forth. So not only are they significantly lower quality, they're often diluted with corn syrup to lower the price. So that's going to mess with your whole glycemic situation. So look, I'm always a fan of look for raw and definitely from within the United States.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for the call. So Zeke, say you're a honey newbie like me, and we want to get maybe three honeys on the rack, three different flavors. Sounds
yep.
like number one, I got to get some buckwheat. That's going to be job one because you mentioned that a lot. What are
yep.
a couple more that might be a good part to my on my spice rack?
I think orange blossom would be number two for me. It just has this big floral, slightly citrus notes to it and is very versatile. And then the second one is our sweet yellow clover. And the sweet yellow clover crystallizes very quickly in this very creamy, spreadable consistency and has these big notes of like cardamom and cinnamon. So those three like give you this big variation and you can really do a lot with them.
And Zeke, very briefly before I let you go, you're clearly a mad scientist in cooking with honey. What is your next experiment?
We actually have an ebook coming out in October for honey and cheese pairing. So if you're interested in that honey and cheese pairing, check out braw.com and download that ebook.
Zeke, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Zeke Freeman. He's a chef and founder and CEO of the honey company Bee Raw. He joins us to share sweet and savory honey-infused recipes for National Honey Month. You can find one of those recipes for candied honey bacon. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, hey, if you've got a recipe, share it. I may check it out.